Devices Radio Network.
Welcome to PED After Hours, a one-hour interview program, raw, uncut, unfiltered, with your host, Taylor Normandy.
This show is brought to you by Napsgear.org. Napsgear is one of the longest-running and most trusted sources of pharmaceutical items and anabolics. With a full selection of everything you could ever need to achieve any of your goals, including a wide array of brands and other health-related items, head to www.napsgear.org and see why the name has been trusted for years. Join the community today. And welcome, everybody, to PED After Hours. This is the one-on-one interview special show with one guest, just me as the host. 45 minutes to an hour, brief but full of info with top names in the industry regarding PED use and everything to do with bodybuilding, contest prep, and all that fun stuff. Thanks to Napsgear for throwing this on. This week, I'd like to welcome former PED radio guest, popular, we had him on twice, very popular guest and well-known prep coach, Dave Kalick. Dave, welcome.
Hello. What's up, Taylor?
Yeah, man. It's been a little bit of a time, but we've had many lengthy discussions in the past, so I figured we'd get back at it, re-go over some of the same stuff, because there was lots of interesting ideas. You were a very popular guest, because there's a few things you said that people wanted you to argue with or were very intrigued with and wanted to learn about, so we can dive right into all those. But you, thankfully, you're cool. A bright guy, and you explain it very well, so people really enjoyed those episodes, so I think it was only a matter of time before we had you back.
Cool. I'm glad. Thanks for having me back.
Perfect. Let's just dig right into the questions, and then any tangents or off notes. Well, before we dive into the questions, just for the people who don't know Dave, he's a very popular prep coach in the Los Angeles area. You can usually find him in the Golds and things like that. He's worked with many IFBB, MPC guys. He's been on PED Radio before twice and plenty of other shows that I won't discuss. And lots of good information from him out there. He's very active in the online community as well. So we're going to dive into some listener questions here and pick his brain and not waste any time. These are partially listener questions and partially just general questions, and we're just going to try to get your overall approach to the whole thing. So let's get started on the off season. The best way to structure an off season PED wise, and sort of if you can tie that into any diet changes, if anything changes as the calories change, vice versa. But where does someone start? Say they got a year or whatever, and they just want to have a productive off season. What do you how do you structure that PED wise?
I mean, as far as, you know, gear-wise, I just want to give an overview, first of all, before we just dive into it. And a lot of these questions can actually, will probably be answered in part as I go into, you know, kind of the subdivisions or breakdowns of the steroid families, but then we can go and we'll rehash the actual questions. So basically, like, you know, there's three different steroid families. There's the testosterone family, which contains, obviously, all the testosterone and all the different esters. And EQ or boldolone, which is actually a subdivision of testosterone, and hence it's found in the same family, and actually dianabol, which is actually methylated boldolone. So that's the testosterone family. When we go into the nandrolone family, we're talking about tranacetate, all the different, you know, tren esters and deca, you know, all the different deca esters. That's the nandrolone family. Okay, then we have the DHT family, where we're going to find, you know, primobolan, anavar, mastrone, winstrol, halotestin. These are the DHT derivatives. So as far as, you know, putting on size and putting an off-season together for building muscle, when choosing steroids for that, we want to use steroids that are, you know, what's called having a high relative binding affinity. And that means how long the steroid can actually bind to the androgen receptors. So in all these three families, the ones that are going to be most successful in that are going to be the long esters, obviously. So when we're talking about the testosterone family, you know, we And this goes to the question of, you know, which esters build more muscle, the shorter or the long-acting ones. So as far as putting on size, we want to work primarily with the long-acting esters. The long-acting testosterones, you know, the enanthate, the cypionate, EQ, which has a really long half-life. And if we're going to talk about a long half-life ester to be used successfully for building muscle in the off-season, believe it or not, primobolan can be used. Because although primobolan is a DHT derivative, it is a very long-acting half-life. And it has the binding capacity like other long esters do. And what's unique about the primobolan is that it is a DHT derivative. So DHT derivatives are very, they have what's called high androgen binding affinity. So it's two different things. So primobolan can actually be used in conjunction with long esters from the other groups to build muscle as well. If we're going to talk about the long ester to use in the nandrolone family, I mean, we have, you know, there's decadecanoate, the long-acting ester. There's, you know, the tren enanthate, which gives us a long-acting ester of trenbolone. Trenhex is also a long ester, but it's not quite as long as the tren enanthate. So as far as building size, I mean, basically what's going to happen is you want to combine the long-acting esters of these groups. You don't necessarily have to have primobolan in there. I'm just giving an example of the DHT derivative, probably the only one that actually does build muscle. Because one of the questions, for example, is long esters versus short esters, more muscle. I mean, the longer there's a half-life that's established, again, the more muscle-building potential it has. I mean, testosterone enanthate is going to build a lot more muscle than testosterone propionate because of the duration of the ester. The propionate wouldn't be around long enough to effectively bind to androgen receptors.
Now, if you're injecting more frequently, though, would the elevated levels not balance that out, or is there a buildup over time with the long esters that's just not you can't replicate?
Exactly. You can't, with propionate, you can't achieve a half-life or blood level that you could with the layered enanthate injection or the cypionate injection. Because, you know, you have basically there's, with enanthate and cypionate, you have basically like, there's like an 8 or 9 day half-life. Which means that basically, like 8 days after the injection, the blood level will be at half what it was at the time of the injection. You know, so if you were to take, you know, 1,000 milligrams of testpropionate a week, you would still have ups and downs of blood levels of it, as opposed to layering together, you know, the long ester injections. You're going to achieve a higher blood concentration of testosterone itself, and one of the questions is, you know, what's the best anabolic along with to build muscle? And actually, I would say without a doubt, it's going to be ecopose. Because ecopose is very similar to testosterone. It has an even longer half-life. The undecanoate ester is like actually active after even like 28 days. So when we're combining testosterone and ecopose, that's really going to be the 1-2 punch right there.
Why do you think, you know, gets considered a weak steroid? Why do you think that is?
I don't know. What is weak? Does weak mean you might not get the initial, like, you know, the blow up inflammatory aspects of, you know, test suspension or, you know what I mean? Or DECA. But you mean ecopose is being a very weak steroid? I don't understand why people would claim that. I know that, I mean, we use it very successfully in a lot of off seasons, and I don't see anything else building more muscle. You might get more of a cosmetic look from other steroids, but as far as building, the ecopose with the testosterone, there's nothing will take the place of that. Trenenanthate is obviously very anabolic and, you know, highly androgenic. It's a non-aromatizing androgen, just like, you know, the other ones are, but you're going to find that a lot of people, we'll get to trend more later, but we'll talk about the progesterone levels that can arise from that when people are progesterone sensitive and how that can be counterproductive, you know?
For sure.
With testosterone and ecopose, a lot of the problems is that there's a lot of, you know, the esters people using, you know, 2 or 3 grams of testosterone. And, you know, keep in mind, if you're someone who's going to be very estradiol sensitive, You know, there's some people who even just on 600 milligrams a week can have estradiol levels through the roof. You know, there's some people who just convert that way. And I've seen some people take 1500 milligrams and have very low estradiol levels. So that's one thing, you know, you definitely want to keep into consideration when using tests. So EQ won't aromatize quite as much. And as far as using trinanate, you know, tren is, you know, I don't, there's an understanding that I guess I'm very against tren and I'm against the abuse of tren. I mean, there's some people who look at a bottle of tren and their prolactin levels go up without even, you know what I mean? They're just so sensitive to it. And people, they think, you know, oh, all you got to do is, you know, you take, caver to combat, you know, prolactin levels from tren. I mean, that's all fine, but you're not going to do anything for crazy high elevated progesterone levels that are exhibited when people are progesterone sensitive.
What are some of the main side effects that people will notice from the progesterone and prolactin?
Well, I mean, if they're progesterone, see, what's cool, okay, what's cool about tren is that a little bit of tren, the right amount, it causes an elevation, a slight elevation in progesterone, which is good, because that becomes agonistic of estradiol. In other words, it helps to lower it, which is why tren can be great for helping you to harden up. That's one of the reasons why it does it. But when someone's progesterone level goes way too high, it becomes antagonistic of estradiol, meaning it will make someone's estradiol levels go through the roof, and I've seen it. So when you're seeing really, really high progesterone levels in conjunction, you know, and there's high estradiol levels, you're going to see the very stubborn visceral fat that won't go away during prep. You're going to see just that film bloated look. And, you know, when those estradiol levels are high, either whether it's from, you know, the antagonistic aspects of progesterone or if it's just fucking high from using too much fucking tests, then you're going to see these are the people you see, really big guys at the shows, whatever, and they're just in the last call out because they're just not in shape.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, some people say, what's the difference between, I know I'm skipping around and bouncing around, but I know some people say, what's the difference between today's look and modern bodybuilding? And, you know, it's like, I think one reason why you see a lot of guys that are out of shape nowadays is really just quite frankly, because of the over abuse of the androgens.
Yeah.
I think back in the 90s, you know, some guys, all those conditionings were incredible. I mean, back then they didn't have the volume that these guys do today, but you know, for the most part, you see really good clean separation and stuff like that because they didn't have the visceral fat buildup that these guys do today from just taking, I mean, so much. It's unbelievable the amount that we see, you know. And mind you, like to the readers out there, I know it's hard to, more is not better. I know that sounds like such a cliche, but it's true.
Yeah, if it was that simple, there would be a pretty straight line for getting huge, right?
If it was that simple, I mean, of course. And just keep in mind, like, you know, I mean, I always say this, but the bottom line is genetics. You know, you can, the steroids, growth hormone, all that stuff, they only enhance what you have genetically. They can't create what you do not have genetically. So, I mean, I've seen guys on budget cycles, you know, back in, you know, sleeping on their friend's couches, not even having barely any money to get ready for a show, get pro cards on very little gear. And I've seen people, you know, taking everything under the sun and placing fourth out of fifth, you know, in a novice division. So again, the emphasis on drugs. I mean, yes, here we are, it's a PED, you know, broadcast. But, you know, again, I just want to emphasize that the abuse of...
Well, the goal is to learn how to use them properly, really, not just to recommend using them, right? That's what we're here for, so...
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I know I'm really bouncing. I know I'm really bouncing around, but I just want to get back to... let's go. I know I'm bouncing around the questions, but tren a must for pre-contest. So again, the non-progesterone sensitive individual, tren is fantastic. And if an individual is not sensitive to it, they should be using tren in the right dosage pre-contest. Mm-hmm. Because again, it's very hardening. And if you get that little bit of progesterone elevation to lower estradiol, I mean, it really hardens you up, helps dry. I mean, it's great for muscularity. So, but then I've seen people who when they take tren, it's extremely counterproductive for them. Fat loss becomes stubborn. You know, and getting back to progesterone elevation from tren, you know, you can't take, that's progesterone. So all the anti-aromatase inhibitors in the world won't control progesterone. Taking CABR, although it will stop prolactin, will not stop the elevation of progesterone. Okay, so, you know, I just want to, you know, there's people who bang out tons of Tren, and they're the ones who shouldn't be using it, some of them, and they're using CABR to try to use a Band-Aid, and they're still seeing the high progesterone levels. So if someone can is good with their levels and stuff like that, then I think Masterone is imperative that it's used pre-contest because it will make you muscular. It's a very cosmetic steroid.
Yeah.
The acetate version. The Tren, okay, for building muscle, this goes back to the earlier questions. Tren and Anthate is the one you want to use for building muscle. There's no use for Tren and acetate in the off-season. You know, the Tren and Anthate, we have the long half-life. We also have more susceptibility, though, because of that half-life of the progesterone elevation. So I know I keep going back to that, but, you know, I think Tren is a very good steroid. I just think, again, that it's the most abused one.
So just a lower dose of Tren and Anthate in the off-season, possibly?
Yeah. Keep in mind, Trenbolone is 3 times more binding than testosterone.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I mean, if you're taking 1,000 milligrams of testosterone, I mean, there's no reason to exceed, in my mind, you know, 300 or 400 milligrams a week, let's say, of Trenbolone. People are different. There's different, you know, dosing protocols for people. But I'm just giving some just basic guidelines that's one. Sorry, that should literally be a third of the amount of milligrams that you're taking testosterone wise. And that doesn't mean if you're taking, you know, you shouldn't be taking 3 grams a week of test anyway. I can take 900 mil. I can take 1,000 milligrams. Exactly. Yeah. And just skipping around, I'm hearing people doing cycles of 1.5 grams a week of Tren, a gram and a half a week of EQ, and 3 grams a week of test, and three energy. I mean, hearing these things, and it's just that, like, it's just crazy. I mean, I go back to, in 1999, was the first time I met Dorian Yates, and he was promoting his products in Venice at the nutrition store there around the corner from Gold's, right next to the firehouse. And I asked him, I was really curious. I was like, you know, what were you using? What did you take, you know? And I was like, I asked him about Tren. I was like, how much? Because back then it was Parabolin. There were 76 milligram Parabolin ampules. He only opened up 3 of those a week. So what's 76 times 3? That was his dosage for Trenbolone. Exactly. So it's nothing. So I'm just saying, I mean, it's, I don't want to sound old fashioned or old school, or whatever, but again, the dosing protocol for what's going on these days is just crazy. And, you know, I mean, at the top pros, they're not taking what a lot of these people are thinking. And there's a lot of armchair people taking these crazy high doses. And there's a lot of armchair people who are taking these doses, not doing well on shows.
They're
not coming in condition. And just forget about all the inflammatory aspects of it, you know, and all the renal and hepatic stress people are doing. It's just, you're going to have trouble getting in shape. Because keep in mind, if you're taking all that stuff, you're taking all that test, you know, it's like you're taking anti-aromatase drugs. So that's going to knock out, let's say you knock out, you're taking even letrozole, and let's say you're knocking out, you know, 78% of the production of estradiol. Well, guess what? That whatever's left over is going to be so high of estradiol, like your 24% is going to be extraordinary compared to someone else's who's on way less.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? So a lot of people are just chasing, you know, and then you take more and more anti-aromatase drugs, you lose sensitivity to those drugs as well. So just some food for thought.
Now, in the off season, if someone's to utilize test and EQ primarily, would you just run that for the entire duration of the off season, or would you switch compounds just to mix it up, or do you just cycle?
It really depends. Honestly, it really depends on the person.
Yeah.
It really depends on the person, the situation, how lean they are, what their past history, what their blood work looks like, what their estradiol levels are during. I mean, I can just tell you, I'm sorry to be vague, but there's some times where, okay, here's a question that'll tie into that. Orals in the off season. Some people, I mean, one problem with orals in general, as we know, is that it fuck up your appetite greatly. We all know this, right? I mean, you see someone goes on Dianabol for a couple of weeks and all of a sudden the appetite just goes to shit. I mean, Anadrol, these are alkylated steroids. You know, like the 17 position alkylated steroids are going to compromise the integrity of your appetite, usually pretty frequently. So I don't really, I mean, sometimes they can be used in the off season, you know, but with some volume here on, you know, to promote some volume, maybe, you know, if you're doing periods of IGF and things like that, we'll get into that. But for the most part, I mean, you really just want to stick to the long esters in the off season. And honestly, more than anything, I hope we get to a little bit is training.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, I mean, in training and eating, you know, sure, what I mean? It's like, it's really, again, you don't need a ton of shit to build. So as far as the off season, just stick to the long esters. Stick to long esters. You don't have to like throw in, you don't have to throw in Mastrone or Trenbolone just because you want to look cosmetically harder during the off. It's, there's no point to it. No point to it. Save those quick esters for pre contest.
Gotcha. We will address
where you want a cosmetic look
for sure, and training, okay, and all that fun stuff, and we will get there for sure. I just want to, insulin's always a hot topic. Some people are afraid to even touch it. How do you address it in the off season versus pre-contest, or when do you use it to, you know, refill? Is it a consistent thing depending on the individual? Basically, what's your overall take on it?
Again, such an individual thing. Insulin can definitely find its place pre-contest. I mean, off season and even pre-contest. Again, you know, there's some people who are not candidates at all for insulin. And, you know, you could see it. So sometimes it's funny, you get when you start off with someone and you see some pictures initially, and there's a lot of, you know, low abdominal fat and lower, you know, where you could see there's when people have poor glucose tolerance levels, you know, there's not, that's not a candidate for insulin. The way people are doing insulin nowadays, where they're using these, they're starting off with really high doses and you lose sensitivity really quickly. And then what's happening is that you're just, when you lose IGF acknowledgement and sensitivity in your muscle cells, what happens is that your lipid cells, your fat cells, become more insulin sensitive, and then you're really fucked. Okay, so I mean, the very, when we're talking about insulin, it's very, I mean, sometimes it depends. There's so many different ways in the off season. You know, there can be, we're going to go into the growth hormone dosing thing as well, I see is one of the questions, but you know, insulin can be used, small amounts of it can be used in conjunction with GH. I mean, there's, it can be used. I mean, there's, but I mean, for the most part, most people, insulin's not being used. I mean, I don't use insulin on a lot of people, on most people. It depends. Depends how lean they are, like how they seem to be tolerating. It's also the types of carbs you use in conjunction with it. There's timing. I think.
Do you use the pre-workout very often, or?
No, one thing is that I'm really not into, what I'm not into, what I was about to say was that I'll be very vague because for obvious reasons, but in the off season, I would generally gravitate more towards the long acting insulin, the Humulin R, again, because of duration and half-life.
Yeah.
I think what's happening is with people doing like, I don't really believe in this pre-workout insulin where people shoot like 15 IUs of quick acting insulin. And then during the workout, they're chasing with tons of glucose, intra-workout glucose and drinks, showing their stomach up with glucose. And I think, you know, fighting off going hypo. And by the way, when all this is going on, you know, your cortisol levels are going up and down too. If you're even getting remotely hypo, your cortisol levels activate, which is very, you know, to me, that's very catabolic, you know? And if you, you know, to just get a good cosmetic pump, you know, to have that quick acting insulin going into the workout, I just, to me, with all the carbs in the stomach, I don't be seeing as being productive. I think that in the post-workout window period where all the delivery really needs to happen, I think there's got to be stimulation during the workout, and then there's got to be delivery and messaging afterwards.
Okay.
So if there is insulin use, I like to use, you know, post-workout. There might be some morning insulin with whatever, but again, I'm not into these high dose protocols of quick acting insulin going into the workout, chasing the carbs up, you know, just not into,
yeah,
I don't think it's productive.
Gotcha. For sure. And do you,
and people are losing, and people, and you know what, it's like, and with people with insulin protocols, I mean, people, when you start off with 15 IUs, I mean, where are you going to go from there? You're going to lose sensitivity very quickly.
For sure.
Like I said, and you're seeing a lot of these, if you're one who has stubborn predisposed areas, that insulin will kick you in your ass, guaranteed.
Is there any time for a pre-contest for maybe a very metabolically gifted individual?
Yes, there is definitely. Sometimes insulin use, some people, you're better off not using it at all in the off-season. They actually fare better during pre-contests when they are lean, when they are, like, sensitive.
Yeah.
You know, insulin can be very, I mean, it can be, you know, there's when there's carb cycling on, we're coming off of keto, there's different, insulin is a very, is a tool that can definitely be used in the right individual, in the right circumstance, pre-contest or off season. I know that's very vague, but there's just so many variables involved.
Does it be like more during refeed days and things like that?
It depends. Some people need more just regular basic, you know, like heavy duty refeeds. Sometimes some people need more high glycemic carb spiking types of refeeds.
Yeah.
Insulin can play a part adjacently to both, or it could be counterproductive in those environments. You know, sometimes you really just want to keep pushing sensitivity through carb cycling and keto patterns, let's say, to encourage glucose tolerance levels so that perhaps maybe insulin can be used effectively. So sometimes, you know, you want to work up to being able to use the insulin. And a lot of times that's getting people to acknowledge glucose better through diet rotations, you know, and so that they can use insulin and they can be productive. In the off season, when someone's really, really lean, I'll just say that they can be very productive, because they're going to have good levels of glucose tolerance and the insulin will do its thing without, you know.
Yeah. I've almost noticed that, like, if you're in really good shape, not overusing it, but mild insulin usage almost has zero effect on body fat. But if you're even a little bit fat, you just start piling it on.
It's exactly the case. Yeah. Because all this has to do, I know I sound very redundant with insulin sensitivity, but the whole thing is that, you know, you see these guys in the off season and they boast all about them gains. Like they spell it DEMGAN, right?
Yeah.
With a Z. And what they're doing is they're just destroying their glucose tolerance levels. They're just messing up. They're eating all this sugary shit after they work out, you know, with insulin, all this crap. And it's like, you never see these guys get like ripped glutes or anything like that, or, you know, just completely torn to pieces because they're messing up their sensitivity, their fat level. Again, Taylor, if someone has a little bit of fat and they're using insulin, guarantee, like the amount of muscle building they're going to get from it, the lipid sensitivity will supersede whatever muscle building you're getting from that insulin. The more insulin sensitivity you lose, the harder it is to build muscle.
Yeah.
And the easier it is to get and or at least to store stubborn fat, especially when people are estradiol sensitive and they have predisposed estrogen areas that are very stubborn and they fill the insulin in, good luck getting in shape. Good luck.
For sure. And you touched on it briefly, but growth hormone, what's your general approach? Are you more of a frequent low doser or do you like to specifically time sort of higher IUs at once?
It depends. There's some times where you want to go for a big kind of a bolus dosage once, you know, in the morning. You know, it depends if insulin's being combined with it, depending on the dosing protocol. Person's dieting, sometimes growth hormone can be used throughout the day in two or three different, you know, couple IU settings in between meals on low blood sugar. I'm not really into the growth hormone post-workout. I would rather use other peptide, things going on there. GH can be used in the middle of the night during low blood sugar, let's say. Sometimes I have clients, they go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, they take it, and they take it again upon awakening. That's one way of doing it. It depends on the type of GH. I mean, you know, if there's some junky stuff out there where, you know, they test out to 5 IUs or 4 IUs per bottle, you know, or you're using farm grade, obviously, where IUs and IU, it's true, you know, then it changes the dosing protocol a lot. I think there's a lot, I think when people are banging out, you know, 10, 12 IUs a day of growth hormone, that's another way of losing insulin sensitivity as well, by the way. So it could be used in the morning. I don't like the GH right before going to sleep, though.
No?
Because I believe, not right before you go to sleep, because I believe that if you're taking synthetic GH before you go to sleep, there's no reason to release your own natural release.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so that's the one time where your body's actually going to do it by itself in an efficient manner, right?
This show is brought to you by napsgear.org. Napsgear is one of the longest running and most trusted sources of pharmaceutical items and anabolics. With a full selection of everything you could ever need to achieve any of your goals, including a wide array of brands and other health-related items, head to www.napsgear.org and see why the name has been trusted for years. Join the community today.
Yeah. Yeah. If anything, that's where we talk about that. That's, if anything, you'd want to, instead of using a synthetic GH before you go to sleep, that's when you'd want to implement a peptide, let's say, you know, for that reason, to take advantage of that time period where you go into the REM sleep and there is more GH release. You'd want to use an antagonistic peptide, you know, like, you know, CJC, whatever, in that window period there. But not the actual synthetic GH, which would shut down your own production.
Now, since you touched on it, which peptides are you a fan of? And have your thoughts changed on any? Or are you still using the same ones?
No, I mean, like, you know what? Like, a while back, and less, seems like in the last year or two, when the GHRP2 and 6 came out, that was really, like, hugely popular, you know? And, you know, what's... when you see like that rapid ghrelin release, so you know, that huge appetite stimulation from it, you know, we know that GHRP2 and 6 is that there's a burst of GH, but there's also, they're showing cortisol levels, progesterone levels activating from it. And after a while, I mean, like I've seen people getting fat on GHRP2 and 6, you know. I think, you know, I mean, I really, what's better, the IPAM, ipramirone, which will do the same burst activity, but without that, you know, progesterone, cortisol levels that can be raised from the 2 or 6, it doesn't give you that ghrelin appetite. Like, you know, you can't go destroy the whole refrigerator.
Which is a good thing for people IPAM. Like me.
Right. But you are going to get that burst release. So, I mean, to me, layering that together, the CJC, you know, like, I mean, without DAC, you know, obviously with the frequency is one problem, but if you use the DAC, it's successful. I mean, I've seen, I don't know if it's, does it take the place of regular GH? In many ways it's a lot better. I mean, you're getting huge releases. If the CJC you're getting is good. I know that there's some companies now that evidently they're not producing good CJC anymore.
I noticed when I took it, it was very, very, almost instantaneously kind of killed my insulin sensitivity though. When I used it, like within a matter of days, no pumps, gained weight, looked like shit. And, it wasn't good for me, but I know other people who use it with great success. So.
Yeah. I mean, everything you said, I've seen there's a lot of different reactions to it. And I've seen, as you said, some people just get highly water retentive from it. I know that the MK77, which is pretty interesting because we know it's, you know, oral bioavailability, but it definitely, like, it seems like, it almost seems like the MK77 is almost like a cross between the IPAM and the GHRP2 and 6, because it does give you that little ghrelin release, that appetite, you know?
Yes.
But... and it does. I know guys are definitely retaining a lot of water from it, some people. So, I don't know. It's kind of an in-between peptide right there. But I mean, people are using, a lot of people are using MK in place of just regular therapeutic GH. You know, instead of like they're taking their 2 IUs of GH for anti-aging, whatever, they're taking MK.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of
that. So it's interesting. I like IGF long R3.
Yeah, there's lots of arguments on when to how and if it's worth it. Is there a specific time you find it's worth much more?
Yeah, post-workout.
Post-workout?
Yeah, post-workout. And by the way, the concept of, you want to inject the IGF into the muscle that you just trained. You know, it becomes systemic after you inject it. So when you inject, if you train your biceps and you inject your biceps bilaterally with it, it's not going to induce more growth in your biceps because you inject it on site. There's not more satellite cell growth at the site of the injection. You'll inject it becomes systemic, and you'll grow more muscle tissue in the area that you just trained, but only because of the fact that it's systemic, not because it's on site. So it doesn't matter where you inject it, by the way, but do it intramuscular post-workout.
Cool. Immediately?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As quick as can. Yeah. Okay. Any other peptides that you have had much success with, or you basically stick with the GH releasers and the IGF-1?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really not, you know, it's not rocking. One thing that I found pretty interesting about the CJC with DAC is that I know there's some people who can use up to, or using up to 10 milligrams a day. I mean, a week.
Yeah.
Have you heard about this?
I've heard of 15 to 20, yeah. Yeah.
So it's funny because back in the day, there was the use of growth hormone from Russia, which was actually from cadavers.
Yes.
And it was very powerful because it was actually, you know, human growth hormone. I've seen some people put on a tremendous amount of muscle from high dose CJC use with IPAM, and it's pretty impressive. And I've seen people really, it's weird, just not really get much of a reaction at all.
Yeah. For me,
so it's strange.
It just made me look terrible. And I pumped my workouts, like my pump sucked. I just smoothed out. It was instantly just badness for me. It was weird.
It's a lot of water retention, right?
I gained 7 right? pounds, yet somehow looked like my muscles were not, you know, the insulin sensitive. Like I wasn't getting a pump. I wasn't reacting. Like I had a cheat meal after a week and nothing fucking happened. No veins, nothing. I'm like, all right, this isn't for me. Not for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Strange. How do you transition from off season to prep? We'll do that twofold. One with the switching compounds, you said to fast esters, like what would be the initial switch and at what point? And also, the first changes to diet.
Again, yeah, as far as the compounds, the switching, that's, it's very, again, it's so dependent on the individual. Some people can run longer esters a lot longer than others. Some people can have long esters layered on top of initiating some of the quicker esters. Some people need to pull out the longer esters way in advance. Some people, you have to lower their long esters or off-season stuff just to kind of get them ready for the pre-contest phase. Some people, see, to me, I almost look at it like it's pre-contest or off-season. To me, it's just one big prep. And so with some people, we'll have... You know, you can keep testosterone and equipoise almost all the way up to the gate. And then some people, you'd have to pull those out months in advance where they couldn't even, you know. I mean, as far as gear, that's probably the best way I can answer that. I mean, there's some transition, you know, when to go from long esters to quick esters. It really depends on the individual. Some people need to start their quick esters way further out.
What would be the main go-to sort of, you know, you're going to test an equipoise. What would be the first stage, whether it's at 16 or 8 weeks? What's usually your initial switch?
It depends. A lot of times there's EQ. Sometimes there's already primobolan involved. Sometimes there's not. Sometimes if someone is a good trend candidate, then there's also trend and endate involved, which I would run and then switch to trend acetate at some point, where I might even go from trenenampate to trenhex to trenacetate, or there might not be any trenenampate at all. They might just wait until 8 weeks out, then we start a tren. Or there might not be any tren, or there might be long esters involved up until 6 weeks out, and then I want to switch to all quick esters. So I really wish I could. I know it's not really an answer. It really depends.
Yeah,
it really, really depends.
But you generally switch.
I mean, for the most,
if they can handle trend, you throw that in. Your other go-tos though would be like Masteron, and just what else would be your? Would you just keep the same general compounds? Just
I mean, I'm into Primobolan.
Okay.
I'm into Primobolan over than more so than Masteron and Ampate. To me, like Masteron and Ampate going from Masteron and Ampate to Mastpropionate is not the same as, let's say, trend and Ampate to trenacetate. I think that you're going to get a lot more success out of the Primobolan as far as using for the long ester DHT derivative. Primobolan, you're asking me a go-to one. Well, the Primobolan can be used, you know, in both circumstances and can be there for the duration. One of the few drugs that actually can be there for the duration.
Multi-purpose, right? Can pretty much be very versatile.
It's a very, Primobolan, yeah, I mean, it's very expensive and you need to find, you know, a real one. I'm sure there's a lot of bullshit Primobolan out there, but yeah, I mean, it's again, Primobolan gives us a long binding affinity of the duration of the half-life. And we also have the high androgen binding affinity. So we get the muscle building aspect of it. And I should say the muscle retention aspect of it. We're also getting that cosmetic DHT aspect of it as well. So we know Mastrone is pre-contest. It's a quick-acting DHT derivative. It's a short-acting version of Primavon. The duration and the half-life is very quick. Winstrol is another DHT derivative, so there's different DHT derivatives, and they have different aspects. Like, for example, Proviron is a DHT derivative, but it's very mild in terms of building muscle. But because of the way that it's situated at the dehydrotestosterone, the way that it's laid out, this particular one, it acts indirectly as an estrogen blocker. I want to make this clear. Proviron is not an aromatase inhibitor. All it's going to do, and all DHT derivatives do this to lesser and to more degree, is they can help to compete with estrogen at the receptor site in terms of blocking it, because the DHT is more binding than estradiol. That's the whole concept of it. It's just that Proviron is more directly suited to that, to blocking. Anavar, being a DHT derivative, is interesting because, you know, there's even sometimes where Anavar, like if someone is really just some food for thought, if someone is really estradiol sensitive to testosterone and they can't have high dose testosterone in the off season because of estradiol, sometimes using like a little bit of Anavar can be good, because that could actually free up testosterone because you have free and available testosterone. So just some food for thought. But primarily for pre-contest, you want to use the quick acting esters.
Gotcha. And just so the last thing we'll cover sort of PED-wise, and then we'll transition to just a little bit of training and wrap this up. Clan and ECA, what do you prefer? What's your take on them? Do you utilize both, or is there one you prefer? Do you go back and forth? I know some people believe in using them both at the same time.
Some people are more beta sensitive than others. These are both combination, or, you know, they both affect your beta fat cells. You know, your beta activities stimulates the loss of brown fat. So some people are very beta sensitive. You know, there's those individuals who take 20 micrograms of clen and they're bouncing off the roof.
Yeah.
And we know the individual who will take 80 micrograms and they don't feel shit. So as far as using them, you can go back and forth. You can use them together. There's a concept of you go back and forth because, you know, you lose sensitivity. The clen, you know, there's a whole concept of using, you know, things like Benadryl at night to help sensitize the beta activity of the clen. You know, I kind of think I believe in that. But you can go back and forth. I mean, you know, the ECA, I've seen it. I mean, ECA was used before clenbuterol first came out. That was the first fat burner.
Yeah, I really find the ECA is a little harder not necessarily the nerve, like just recovery in general. Like after,
there's a lot more cardiac. Well, here's the deal. I mean, neurologically speaking, the clen is more, you know, you get the shaking and stuff. But from a cardiac standpoint, I mean, Excedra is very tough, you know, cardiac wise. You hear about the people who are just there. Tons of heart palpitations. That happens on clen and stuff like that too. But I mean, yeah.
Yes. So do you notice that some people respond fat loss wise much more to one than the other? Or is it pretty much straight across the board, just how they tolerate the drug?
I think it's pretty much straight across the board. Although I've seen people like on clen for a while then switch, you know, to ECA and get a really good effect and vice versa too.
Yeah.
So again, I think, you know, some people lose sensitivity quicker than others. I know the clen, the neurological, the shaking might dissipate after a while. There's receptor downgrading from that point. But the thermogenic aspect of it, it pretty much is, you know, it's beta activation, so it's always going to be there. It might fade and dissipate after a while, but it'll be there. You know, there's nothing wrong with sometimes in the middle of prep, you know, maybe taking 5 or 7 days, 5 or 7 days off and going back on it as well.
For sure. You want to touch on training, the most important thing pretty much of them all, along with diet, training in the off season. Really alluded to, you know, that's the frustrating part that a lot of people pay attention to.
It just seems like in the advent of social media and everything, we see the pussification of the sport. And what I mean by that is people are putting drugs first. They're putting their social media. I mean, people are you see a lot of incomplete physiques up there, specifically in legs and back, because there's a lot less, there's not enough compound movements being done with training. You see a lot of incomplete backs. There's a lot of hammer strength stuff, a lot of cables and stuff like that. But we don't see, I don't see enough, you know, heavy ass T-bar rows, one arm dumbbell rows, barbell rows, deadlifts off the ground. And these are the compound exercises that are needed. And, you know, it's like, you know, I hate to say it, but you go back, you look at Arnold and Franco back in the days and all the compound stuff they were doing. I mean, they had the muscle density. You just can't mimic it with just machines. You know, machines play a part. I'm not an anti-machine person. I don't want to say that, but I guess people are putting way too much of an emphasis on the cycles, on the drugs, and they're just not shut up and squat, you know, go in the gym and move the weights. You know, there's also a lot of, you don't see a lot of control, like on the negative aspect of the movement. You know, like if you're leg pressing, make sure you have some type of negative control on the way down. You know, when you, and come get a full range of motion. A lot of people, you know, you don't have to come all the way down, your coccyx bone lifts off and you herniate a disc. But I'm saying you got to come down far enough where you feel your hip flexor and your IT band relax, and you push and push out just short of locking out. Keep tension on the muscle. There's not enough constant tension training out there. Get a good contraction when you're training. If you're doing a preacher curl, make sure you're getting a real deep contraction in the top. Don't come all the way up so high where you're involving your anterior delt in the movement. You know, come three quarters of the way up, get a contraction in the bicep, and then get a deliberate negative on the way down. And then when the bicep tendon is extended, not your arm, but when the bicep tendon is extended, so this is like maybe 85% of the way locked out, come all the way top and contract again, and then get a real full squeeze on the way down. If you're doing rows, you're doing T-bar rows, barbell rows, the range of motion is from your scapula. You want to have your scapula, your shoulder blades round out, and then you want to pull back and get a strong contraction. And then again, a deliberate negative. So there's just, you know, there's got to be more compound training.
Yeah.
I just really see people, I mean, we're at Gold's in Venice, Power. I've seen people train gyms around the world, you know, and it's, I don't know. I just think people are more, I sound redundant again. People just more into the drugs, I think, than actually really busting their ass.
It's funny you mention that about the body parts. It's like, I know it's probably is a training thing, but it's like, you know, everyone knows delts and stuff respond really well to high drugs, but you can just tell a drug body, the guys that say big arms, big shoulders, and then they have no fucking back. Even chest seems to lack. They have no front to back thickness.
Exactly.
They have no legs are obvious, but it's just that they don't, like the back and chest are just not there, and it's just arms and delts.
Yep. Yeah. What you'll see exactly. What you'll see is you'll see a lot of it. That's exactly right. You'll see a lot of incomplete development where you'll see like rhomboid development from all the pull downs and the more comfortable movements. You'll see the upper back development, but you'll see very little like erector development. You know what I mean? Lower lat, like a little thickness. You're not seeing it. The drug build, as you said. Yeah. Then you see with legs, you'll see like some teardrop development. You'll see, you know, you won't see that lateral head really develop because a lot of people are just not squatting or finding excuses not to squat, or they're just not fucking training hard enough. It's amazing. Like people are like, oh, I train legs really hard. I train legs really hard. And they come to Venice and they're puking their guts out after the second exercise. We're not even doing shit yet. You know, it's just, you know, and you see on stage, you'll see a lot of guys, exactly what you're saying, Taylor. You see guys with huge arms. And you'll see like the incomplete areas in the back and the chest, and you just see some massive arms, which of course are a lot of times shot up.
Yes.
You know, so yeah, there's not enough. I don't want to. I know I sound like one of the old back in the day, but you know what? It's like these things will never change as bodybuilding becomes more modernized. Whatever, there's certain bread and butter things that won't or shouldn't change. You know, you can't. There's too many people trying to reinvent the wheel with fancy exercises. I mean, they're good, but you can't take the place of good compound exercises. And, you know, if your legs, I mean, you know, and people make an excuse not to squat, whatever, you know, it's like for the most part, you got to squat. I mean, the guys with the biggest legs today, they may not be squatting as much because they've already, but they've established their legs with squatting, you know, it's, you know, you should actually be wrapping and setting up and stepping out and actually like taking your time to squat and really like, you know, it's got to be important as bench pressing.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, you're saying you're seeing incomplete chest development because a lot of guys are just focusing on hammer strength stuff. It's easy to make a training video where you load up a hammer strength plates and stuff like that.
The hammer incline is like my, as soon as I see a video of a guy doing a hammer incline, I don't care how many plates are on, just fuck off. You know?
I think I lost you there. Can you repeat it?
Oh, sorry. I was just saying the hammer incline machine is like, as soon as I see a video start on the hammer incline, I'm just like, I don't care. No one cares.
Yeah.
Everyone can do four plates on it. Just go away.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you see in development, like you see, it's just, you'll see incomplete chest development. You'll see an over development of the anterior delt, the front delt. Because people are just trying to move a lot of weight mechanically without, you know, getting their chest really involved in moving. There's not an arch to the back, you know, it's just pushing. And back too. I mean, you got to row. You got to do barbell rows. You have to do T-bar rows. You have to do one-arm dumbbell rows. The back-supported hammer strength is great, and we use them. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we use machines. We use hammer strength. But as adjacent to the compound exercises, not in place of.
For sure.
You see so many guys with very incomplete lower backs, very little deadlifting going on.
That's very true. Yeah, lower backs. And some reason, I think a lot of it, the lats are always lacking. I don't know if that's just me because I only hang around, you know, there's mostly white dudes around here and we just suck with our lats. But I know how to target
The lats are lacking because people are not rowing. They're not setting up, they're not doing barbell rows off the ground. They're not doing deads. They're not taking heavy ass dumbbells and rowing. You know, the top guys are. But, I mean, you know, everyone talks about, you know, gunning for that pro card hashtag and all this stuff. I mean, put the work in.
Oh, shit.
This is going to take work.
All right, Dave.
Take a lot more than drugs.
Yeah, no shit. Thank you very much for coming on. We'll have you back. We always like to have you. Next time we can pick a few more specific topics and get right in depth. Where can people reach you if they're interested in hitting you up for coaching or anything like that? Follow your clients and all that fun stuff. Plug yourself.
You guys can hit me up on Facebook at Dave Kalick. You can also email me at Dave Kalick at Yahoo. DaveKalick. I apologize to all the readers for going off topic, you know, fluttering out about a lot of stuff, but, you know, just wanted to get everything out. And I know I do it pretty ugly, but hopefully it was informative to everybody today.
For sure. Do check out Dave's stuff. And if you're looking for a good coach, hit him up. We've talked to him many times and we'll talk to him again. Dave, thank you very much for an hour of your time. And we will talk to you soon.
You're very welcome, Taylor. Thanks for having me on.
Voices.